Since the first fleet dropped anchor in 1788, close to 10 million immigrants have moved from across the world to start a new life in Australia. They've arrived in waves. They've been encouraged by developments like the 1850s gold rush, or to escape adverse conditions at home such as the Industrial Revolution, the social upheavals that occurred in 19th century Britain, or to escape the two world wars or the aftermath of the Vietnam War in the 1970s. Collectively, these immigrants have helped shape what was initially a uniquely British-based and now has become a multicultural society in Australia. So in today's podcast, I chat with leading demographer Simon Kirstenmacher about the history of migration and how it's changed our culture and our property markets over the years, and what's likely to happen ahead and how our changing demographics are going to affect our property markets. And in particular, we're going to have a talk about what's happening to migration now because of our border restrictions and what this means. So welcome to today's show.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialise in helping you grow, protect and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
The immigration history of Australia began with the initial human migration to the continent around 80,000 years ago, when the ancestors of their Aboriginal Australians arrived on the continent. Then from the early 17th century, the continent experienced its first coastal landings and explorations by Europeans. We know from the lessons we learned in school that the permanent European settlements began around 1788 with the establishment of a British penal colony. But it was the discovery of gold in the 1800s in Bathurst, New South Wales, and then in Victoria that transformed Australia economically, politically, and demographically. And immigrants have been wanting to come to our lucky, rich country ever since then. From early Federation Australia, maintained a white Australia policy, and that was abolished after the war. And after that, we ended up having a multicultural Australia. And from the 1970s, there's been a significant increase in immigration from Asia and other non-European countries. Now, we know over the last decade, immigration's been booming, with the number of immigrants accounting for almost half Australia's population growth at times. But obviously, things have changed over the last year or two. And our borders have been closed, and this is going to have implications for property, for businesses. And you know that I believe demographic trends are an important factor to take into account in property and in business. So I'd love having my regular chats with leading demographer Simon Kirstenmacher. I'd like to unpack what's happening with migration moving forward. So Simon's Director of Research at the Demographic Group. Welcome, Simon.
Ah, thanks for having me again.
Now, Simon, population growth and particularly immigration is a topic that should interest everybody, not just people involved in property, but all of us. What's happened with the number of new residents? What's happening to our nation at the moment?
Well, we need to, of course, go back to COVID as the main driver for population movements recently. Before the pandemic, we say in rough estimates, about two-thirds of our population growth came from migration. And only one-third came from natural increase. That means more births than babies. Now, on average, we had around plus 200,000 net population growth through migration, up to 300,000 new migrants per year at the absolute height. And now they completely disappeared during COVID because we're not letting anyone in. We actually had an outflow of migrants. More migrants left Australia than came into Australia for the first time since the First World War, really. So that's been a long while since this was last the case. And that, of course, impacts not just the property market, but every sector of the economy.
Sure. So looking back before COVID, how did our percentage of population that are immigrants compare to other countries? Because we see it as a very multicultural country.
Oh, our country is so much more multicultural than other nations. If you just look at our largest cities, we have about 42% of all Sydneysiders being born outside of Australia. And that compares to figures of Berlin around 13-15%. And maybe there's a couple of international cities that come close, but they don't reach the level of a Sydney or Melbourne, which is just under the average number for Sydney. And even small towns in Australia are so much more international than big capital cities across Europe, for example. We have a small town like Horsham. We have Wagga Wagga, where we have 13-15% of the population born overseas. We are a truly multicultural nation in Australia.
So, Simon, and people often forget that when we look at net migration, it's not just skilled migrants who come, but it also includes students, doesn't it? And those people that we let in for humanitarian reasons.
Absolutely correct. And we need to understand that when people are concerned about migration and they focus on asylum seekers, for example, that's not really a valid argument because these are tiny numbers of visas that we let in, like 6,000-7,000 per year or thereabouts. It's not much. It doesn't make a difference to the population base. The real big driver for population growth in recent years from migration was actually international students. They're, of course, a very attractive migration source because they pay good money for their education. And later on, one in six international students actually becomes a permanent resident, which is very nice for us because we get people that were educated on our standards. And they become residents after they already had their very expensive first 20 years or so of the life cycle in other countries. Because as a human, you cost the state money before you start earning, and you cost the state money after you stopped earning.
So we've been encouraging immigration, I guess, since the Second World War. My parents were migrants and brought me to Australia in the 1950s. It was what was known then as the populate or perish movement. It gathered momentum after the Second World War. It delivered waves of European migrants to Australia in the late 20th century. It's been a major driver of our growth, hasn't it, and our prosperity.
Definitely. And so, of course, you can easily grow GDP through the sheer number of people that you add to the country, because then you amp up construction, you amp up the real estate sector, those people consume, so the supermarkets benefit, those people need to go to school, so the public sector benefits. So just the sheer number of being a large country, that actually helps. But there is more to this. The kind of nature of the migrants, their background, that changed. When we talk about the 1950s, when you came over, the 1960s, the waves of migration were first Anglo, then they became Mediterranean, the Greeks and the Italians, and then they slowly shifted to Asian and more Arab waves of migration. So the migrant stock, as we call it, shifted from Western countries to Eastern countries.
It also changed consumer behavior. I know when we first came, there weren't European delicatessens. My grandparents were from Europe, and you couldn't get Cabana, and you couldn't get those sort of cheeses. You couldn't get spaghetti as much as you can today. It changed the way we ate, but it also changed our houses and how we live, because we had British-type houses in the past, didn't we?
Oh, absolutely. And it's quite nice when you think about the first waves of Italian and Greek migrants coming to Australia, moving into British houses, and then thinking about why do we live in a British house when we live in a Mediterranean climate? Wouldn't it be smarter to add a bit more outdoor, indoor living to our properties? And that's how then the Australian property market actually adjusted to the new ideas that were brought into the country. Integration is not a one-way street where the foreigners learn the Australian ways. We Australians really take on the smart things that the waves of migrants actually have to offer to us as well.
Well, I remember when the first pizza restaurant opened up. It was a Toto's in Carlton in Melbourne. And in my area, there was the first pizza restaurant in Glen Huntly Road, Elstonwick. And let me tell you a little story. It was called Mergolini's Pizza. And as a teenager, we'd go there. And this was amazing because before there was only Chinese restaurants or fish and chip shops. People can't imagine that there wasn't all these restaurants around. And interestingly, the gentleman who owned Mergolini's Pizza, which was an institution in that area for a long time, had a daughter called Rita, who now for the last 8-9 years has been one of the property strategists at Metropole. So the circle goes around. And we figured that she probably, when she worked in the restaurant as a kid, served me pizza back in the 1970s. But it was pizza then. And then we got more of a fusion of Asian and Indian foods in our culture. So the sort of migrants have changed, haven't they?
Exactly. And so you do see this in the top 10 countries that make up the migrant stock. Back in the 50s, 60s, that was really dominated by European countries, the top 10 migrant nations in Australia. And by now, the British or the English are still the number one country, but by now we have India and China on number 2 and 3, and our Kiwi friends, they are actually only the fourth largest migrant group by now. They were kicked off ranked number 2 that they held for so very long.
We were always the preferred destination of people pre-COVID. I can imagine once the borders open up, we're going to increase our rate of immigration again. First of all, people are going to want to come here, but we're going to want to grease the wheels of industry and have more people paying tax and have more people buying our services and goods.
Absolutely. So we still need to remember that even though we don't have migration at the moment, this is only because of COVID. It's not because the demand for people that want to come to Australia dropped in any significant way. We still will see all the international migrants come to Australia or international students come to Australia simply because we still live in a world that needs more and more university-educated, highly skilled people. So those people will want to come to Australia. And we will also still continue to take in all those skilled migrants because we already see in many industries that we suddenly experience a skill shortage because our economy actually recovered so much faster, you know, this famous V-shaped recovery than anyone really expected. So all of a sudden, these players, the big players, need more skilled migrants. We can't create all of those jobs based on the workers that we already have in Australia. We can't just upskill enough young people for those jobs. We rely on migration. And so lots of businesses, lots of industries really hope that borders will open up rather sooner than later so that they can continue to grow their industries.
Now, prior to COVID, we had around a population growth of 300,000, 330,000 people. And when you divide an average household as 2.5 people, it created a need for 130,000 dwellings each year. And the only way we could deliver those was deliver them in bulk was really those high-rise apartments or the new estates. It was a bit hard to do otherwise. So I know that there have been areas of oversupply. I can see moving forward that'll get soaked up a bit. And when we get that new wave, there could well be a shortage, particularly of the apartment market, where there isn't much of a pipeline at the moment.
Yeah, so that's the big problem that we have at the moment, that, of course, lots of those skilled migrants, lots of those international students that we were used to have in Australia and that now left the country, they are largely emptying or leaving behind 1- and 2-bedroom, relatively small units. We also, at the moment, have the big millennial generation that don't have families yet, just those couples that are now leaving 1- and 2-bedroom apartments behind. So at the moment, we have this big stock of empty, unused 1- and 2-bedroom apartments. So therefore, it is right now not very attractive to build more of the stock that we are currently have an oversupply of. But of course, apartments take years to be built, to be planned. So there is a real risk that at some point in the future, we have a undersupply of just this housing stock that we currently have a massive oversupply in. And it's a bit much, of course, to ask any developer at the moment to take this big gamble on this and say, you know what, in 5-6 years, we're pretty sure we amp up migration enough to really allow for a bigger demand in inner suburbs for 1-2-bedroom apartments to be there. We suspect that this would be the case, but if you have to invest billions of dollars into this, all of a sudden, you might be a bit more careful in how you manage this.
Well, I think moving forward, we're going to need more family-friendly apartments. You made a comment a moment ago about the millennials moving out, and they're moving into the next stage of their life. And post-COVID, a lot of them are going to want to live in houses, detached properties. More are going to start living in townhouses, so they've got big modern accommodation on more compact land. But just because of the cost of living, we do need more apartments, but we need different apartments than we built in the past.
Exactly. So when we talk about the housing life cycle that people go through, so you start living with your parents, then after high school, after uni, maybe during uni, you move out, you move in some sort of rental apartment, either a shared house or a small apartment by yourself. Then you partner up, you move in with your partner, then you add kids, you probably then need to move to a larger house. Later on, you downsize and you probably die. And every generation moves through this life cycle, the size of a generation plays a big role. At the moment, by far the largest generation in Australia is the millennial generation. Around 7 million people fall into this category, born between 82 and 99. They're about 1 billion people larger than the next biggest generation. So that means if this big millennial generation at the moment is about to empty the 1- and 2-bedroom apartments that they're in, and they now seek 3- and 4-bedroom family-sized dwellings, they leave behind the 1- and 2-bedroom stock that's now empty, that needs to be taken over by the next generation. But the next generation, Gen Z, as we call them, is much smaller. So that leaves supply issues there or oversupply issues there. And all of a sudden, the big millennial generation faces undersupply in the market because they need 3- and 4-bedroom apartments or houses. They don't really care about the dwelling type as much as they care about the number of bedrooms. So really, there is a real opportunity out there for developers to offer family-sized apartments in the inner suburbs, because at the moment, the big issue that millennials face is that they really arrange their life with their partners in the inner cities. And now that they add a family member, a baby first, then a second baby, they need to make the decision for themselves whether they shift from the inner city to suburbia. Are we that kind of couple? Do we actually want to become a suburban family? Or would we rather enjoy living the inner city lifestyle with a family? It's up for every individual couple to decide this, but there is surely a large enough market for young couples that will want to stay rather central, but at the moment they can't simply because the stock isn't available.
No, it hasn't been the sort of apartments that have been built. We've been missing out on that. But other parts of the world, that's exactly how people live, isn't it? Particularly in Europe.
Exactly. The European model has long been 3- to 4-bedroom apartments being actually available. You just need to go to Copenhagen, Stockholm, Berlin, any kind of British city. These apartments do exist. But the reason they weren't built in the last couple of years is that when you build a big tower, it is just more profitable to sell 1- and 2-bedroom apartments within this tower than 3- or 4-bedroom apartments because you sell square footage and you sell the whole package. So that means in the past, there wasn't a market force that was actually driving developers to build this. But I think if over the next 5 to 10 years, you want to offer an attractive apartment stock in the inner cities, if this is your business, if this is your skill set of providing these, you will need to shift to offering larger apartments because that's where the main demand for housing will come from in Australia.
Also, baby boomers downsizing, if they move into an apartment, are going to want more space than what's currently offered as well. Now, Simon, I'd like to just have a bit of a chat about what's currently happening to migration and tourism numbers, because we've got about a year's worth of data now. So let's have a look at that. Let's unpack it. How badly has the tourism sector been suffering?
Oh, tourism has been hit extremely hard. We do know that we have so many sectors in Australia that heavily depend on the number of tourists that come into Australia. In the 12 months before COVID, we had close to 6 million tourists arrive in Australia. They, of course, spent money. On average, they spend around $5,400 in Australia. That if you add all this up, that means that the tourists spent $2.7 billion in Australia. Now their 6 million went down to 16,000 tourists that arrived over the last 12 months where COVID Wow. was a thing. So it means that completely wiped out this big fat industry. It gets buffered to a small degree by Australians who would have, went on vacation overseas, vacationing in the country instead. But it's not enough to actually help this big hit that some of those tourist towns had to take. And particularly considering that some of the towns that depended on tourism so heavily were also recently hit by bushfires in the years past. So it's a sector that suffered rather strongly.
Simon, the student accommodation sector has also suffered because we just aren't getting the international students.
Exactly. It's almost the same story as with tourists. We, in the 12 months before COVID, about 800,000 international students arrived in Australia. Over the last 12 months, it was only 1,700 students arrived. So again, that is a sector that got wiped off Australia. So that's another big sector that's struggling. That said, the international student industry, in the property sector, international purpose-built accommodation players, they're not actually that pessimistic about their future because they do know that they have a very attractive and strong product that they're linked to. And so lots of those players are actually eyeing big properties in the inner cities. They want to invest rather than divest because they see this as a temporary lull in the market where it might be worth investing in, because they are pretty sure that once borders are open, the boom will only be strengthened, considering that the largest competitor in the international education market, the US, has not been viewed under a favorable lens over the last 4 years under Trump, lots of racist issues that occur in the US that we don't have occurring in Australia.
Of course, we do have something hanging over our heads because a large number of the tourists and in the past students have come from China. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
That is always the big question mark. We are increasingly closely linked financially, socially, culturally even with China. So any kind of major geopolitical change that impacts China will have impacts on us. And we can only hope, if you will, that this doesn't happen. But it's also the idea that the stronger you are economically tied up with another country, the less likely any direct conflict is between Australia and China. So I would say that's probably very unlikely, whereas conflicts regarding China and Taiwan, for example, we might view this as more likely. And we don't have a direct impact into how a conflict like this might play out. But we do know that we will probably not be impacted in a positive way should China decide to invade Taiwan.
So there's lots of unknowns, but I think we both agree that once the vaccine works, the virus gets under control, our government, and whichever side of government it's going to be, is really going to want to keep our borders open them up widely and get as many immigrants, students and tourists back in. They've taken on extra debt, even though it's not as big as people initially thought. And one way of extinguishing that debt is to get more people to spend, pay taxes, earn income.
Oh, fully correct. So I can't imagine a plausible scenario where a treasurer of whatever government, whatever party there might be, is willing to give up the beautiful GDP increases that a high migration program, will bring with it.
So we are the lucky country. People have wanted to come here. There's always a queue, a line of people wanting to come into this country. We just take it for granted, Simon. It's not the same in other parts of the world. There isn't a queue of people wanting to get into many other countries like ours. So our future is assured. We're lucky that we're here now. And I think we don't always, well, maybe we didn't appreciate it as much until the last year or two when we see how much fortune we have compared to others. I always enjoy our chats, and I think the conclusion of my chat with you today is that good times are ahead, and it's important to understand the demographic trends, and we are living in a lovely multicultural country.
Beautiful. I couldn't agree more.
Look forward to our chat again real soon, and it's also looking forward to catching up with you at Wealth Retreat 2021 on the Gold Coast, where I know you're going to unpack your detailed research about what's ahead for our economy, our property markets, and for business people.
Oh, that'll be a great event at the Gold Coast, because we can actually check into Australia from so many different angles and understand what it means for business, what it means for your personal investment strategy, if you will. So it'll be good fun, and it will be in the sun. What more can you ask for?
That's right. See you then. Bye. I hope you got some benefit from my chat with Simon Kirstenmacher. And if you want to get a few more ideas about property, money, tax, finance, I've got a heap of ebooks and reports available for you. Just go to podcastbonus.com.au. I'll leave a link in the show notes, podcastbonus.com.au, and you'll instantly get access to these ebooks and reports. Now, following on from what I was saying with Simon, Australia's got a business plan. It wants to grow our population to 40 million people by the middle of this century. Now, whether it's going to get to that or not, who knows? But as we've already explained, Australia needs to import more people to increase our skill levels, to make our economy keep moving, and in due course to replace the baby boomers that are slowly retiring. And all that is important when we look at how it's going to affect our property markets and which areas of Australia are going to outperform. And in general, the majority of these people are going to come to the capital cities, and particularly the three big capital cities. And that's going to underpin growth in our property markets in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. But it doesn't mean that all markets in those locations are going to do well. So if you want to develop financial success through property investment, you've got to choose the right locations in one of our big three capital cities. And in particular in the short term, even though our markets are moving strongly at the moment, there are still some segments of the market that are languishing. So now more than ever, you need correct property selection to ensure your financial success. And you can trust the team at Metropol to provide you with direction, guidance and results, because we have our own on-the-ground team in each of those cities. No one else can offer you that depth of experience and perspective. But before we even start talking about property, we always help our clients by putting a strategic property plan together for them. Planning is bringing the future into the present, so you can do something about it now. Why not have a look at our services at metropol.com.au? And if you choose to, you can use our buyer's agent services, Australia's most trusted buyer's agents. You may want to use wealth advisory, financial planning, property management, renovations or development, but it all starts by putting a plan together for you. So whether you're a beginner or an experienced investor, at times like this, you need more than a buyer's agent. You need more than a property strategist. You actually need a holistic approach to your wealth. And that's exactly what you get from my multi-award-winning team at Metropol. I look forward to being part of your ongoing wealth creation journey.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message today, I'd like to share a list of things with you that you'll regret in the future if you don't do now. Now, I talk a lot about money and property in these podcasts, but when you get to know me, you'll realize that I believe true wealth is what you're left with after they take all your money away. Sure, money's important in some aspects of your life, but it's not important in others. So these 12 things that I'm going to discuss with you, I think are just important as money and will help you enjoy the journey. If you don't enjoy the journey to your final destination, you're not going to enjoy the destination. So the first thing I'd like to remind you is to put your health and your wellness above everything else. Look, there's an old saying, if you don't have your health, you've got nothing. And this is very true, isn't it? Boys that have been brought home over the last year or two, what's the use of having all the money if you're in one of those countries at the moment where you're stuck indoors with COVID or you're even worse in hospital? The other lesson I'd like to show you is take time to do things you love. Now, I know it might sound cliche, but work a little bit less and play a little bit more. Now, I'm not saying don't work hard. You're not going to get anywhere if you don't work hard, but you're never going to regret taking a vacation or engaging in a new hobby or spending a day with those who make you happy, because there has to be a balance. There's always going to be more work to do, so balance your life and enjoy it. The third lesson I'd like to share with you along this theme is stop taking life so seriously. Why are you taking life so seriously anyway? Why are you worrying about all those things? Because remember, most of the things we worry about never happen, or if they do happen, they're not as serious as we thought they're going to be, and down the track, I don't know, in 2 years, in 2 days, they're not going to be as important as they seem to you today. So stop taking life so seriously. The fourth lesson I'd like to share with you is always say what you need to say. If you love somebody, tell them. If somebody hurt you, tell them. If you've got trouble expressing your feelings, sure, you can write a letter or write an email, but that's not the way to do it. Make sure those around you know each and every day how you feel. Another lesson I'd like to share with you is open your mind to possibilities. This is one of the things I share with people in my mentorship program, that they really should reach for the stars. And if they don't do it and only get to the moon, that's no problem. But there's always ways of doing things. Open your mind to possibilities. The sixth of the 12 little life lessons I'd like to share with you today is follow your own path. Live a life true to you. Stop comparing yourself to others. Stop striving for perfection. Stop living a life based on expectation of others. This has obviously been made worse by social media over the years, where, you know, everyone shows you what they bought for lunch, what they ate, what they dressed, all the things that look good, sound good, but you don't see all the stories behind it. I mean, look at Melinda and Bill Gates, who recently divorced, and everyone thought, gee, they were happy, and look at the billions of dollars they've got. So follow your own path, live a life that's true to you. The seventh lesson is stop living in the past. Right now, you need to throw away the regrets of the past. It's gone. There's no point dwelling on what could have been. Doing so is only going to rob you of the present moment of joy. The past doesn't exist other than as a memory. It's a mental story and it can't be changed. So don't live in the past. What happened, happened. Move on to the future. Now, the eighth little lesson is accept things you can't change. I mean, there are some things you can't change. So rather than being upset by them, worrying about them, being concerned, work on the things you can change, things you've got control over, and don't get upset by the things you can't control. Accept things you can't change. Another of these little life messages, lessons I'd like to leave you with is practice mindful living. Mindful living will slow down time. It will enhance the present moment. It'll fill otherwise mundane days with awe and joy. So pay attention to what you're doing. When you're there, be there. In other words, if you're with your kids or your friends, don't have the phone on. Don't look at Instagram or Facebook. Practice mindful living. Another little hint is stop chasing money, fame, and possessions. Now, we crave wealth. We want prestige. We want fame. We want popularity. We're normal. We're human. We crave material things and beautiful people. And we mistakenly think happiness is going to arrive when we get these goals. My suggestion to you is instead enjoy your life. If you're constantly in pursuit of something other than where you are right now, you're not going to be enjoying the experience. And at the end of the life, your expensive BMW won't be what's flashing in your mind. You'd more likely be smiling at the memory of, I don't know, your loyal dog. So stop chasing material possessions. There's no real happiness there. Only an endless pursuit. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you shouldn't be building an asset base to protect your future. But I'm suggesting put it all in perspective. The 11th lesson I'd like to remind you of is always practice gratitude. If you're not grateful, you won't ever be rich. We know all those rich people who we've heard the stories of rich people who are miserable, they're sour, they don't appreciate what they've got. You're living in the best country in the world at the best time in history. Appreciate it. And the last of these 12 little things I'd like to talk to you about today that I believe are going to be important and you'll regret in the future if you don't concentrate on them today is the message of love. Pay attention to all the sources of love in your life. And you're going to develop a growing sense of abundance. You're going to see beauty around you each day. You're going to be optimistic rather than pessimistic. So there you have it. A list of 12 just little independent random thoughts, a list of things that I think you'll regret in the future if you don't do them now. If you got some benefit from today's show, why not help somebody else who you know would get benefit? Somebody who'd like to know what's going to happen to our demographics moving forward so they can make better property investment or business decisions. Just tell them about the Michael Yardney podcast. Now, if you want to get that bonus report package that I talked to you about, the ebooks and the reports, just go to podcastbonus.com.au. And if you'd like to find out more in between these shows, just look for me on social media, Michael Yardney. And I also have a private Facebook group where every day I leave some commentary, some thoughts, a chart or something that I won't share elsewhere. So go to Facebook and look for the private Facebook group, the Property Update private Facebook group, and I'd love to share my thoughts with you too. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?